Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It is the Disruption Zone. My friend Josh Crawford with the Pegasus Institute is back with us again. We love this guy and we love the Pegasus Institute. They are doing an incredible amount of work in terms of diving and delving into policy and data that is super important for Kentucky's future. And nationally, too, for that matter. It's PegasusKentucky.org if you want to check out their website. Josh, welcome back. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
I want to start with a couple of things. Let's start with the protests in Portland, the wall of moms and the federal agents there. As a conservative who leans libertarian, I'm actually quite concerned about sending in federal officers to deal with something. I don't have any sympathy for these Antifa protesters who have been burning and looting and breaking things. I can't resist the opportunity to make fun of a group that calls itself the Wall of Moms and say, wait, these poor angry Antifa boys had to call their moms in to protect them. But
exactly.
That's aside from the point. We can have some jokes at their expense, but at the same time, I think all Americans should be concerned when the president starts calling in federal police to deal with issues that are decidedly local.
Yeah, so there are two things at play here, right? One is straightforward. One, I think, is a bit more complex. So federal statutes allow for the deputizing of federal law enforcement individuals, ICE, Secret Service, organizations like that, to go in and protect federal property and federal land. And
right.
So the initial justification for this was there
federal
had
building.
Been repeated vandalism of the federal courthouse there. There had been attempts to burn down the federal courthouse there. And so we're going to send in some federal law enforcement to protect the courthouse, protect federal property inside Portland. And there's a bit of a gray area as to what extent or sort of what the jurisdiction is of those law enforcement individuals once they're in a place. So
yeah.
Do you have to wait till they're on federal property? If you see somebody walking mm-hmm. towards it with a Molotov cocktail, or you see people gathering over there and they're looking at that building, can you go over and can you interact with them? There's some legal gray areas there about what exactly they can do.
Right.
But what is undisputed is that federal law enforcement can, and in the case of Portland, probably should be involved in the protection of federal property within that city.
The question that I have and the concern that I have, and I want to look at this objectively because I was just reading a Wall Street or Washington Post article that just, like the mainstream media, is just they are absolutely defending and minimizing the violence that has taken place in some of these protests. These protests, what's happening in Portland doesn't have anything to do with George Floyd's death. It has everything to do with destroying our system of government. And there was reports of federal agents, you know, kidnapping people from these protests in unmarked vans. I don't know if any of that's true or if that's hyperbole. I would be concerned if that was true, but I also want to make it clear, some of the people that are involved in these protests, some of them, a very small amount of them, but some of them are actually at the level of terrorists, in that
right.
the actions that they're taking are beyond the protocol for a free assembly of the people. And that when that
right.
happens, there are harsher consequences. Now, again, I want to sort through that, and I don't think either you or I have the specific details of what's on the ground in Portland. But the president is talking about expanding this program. And I don't really think there's anybody out there explaining to the American people one way or the other what the parameters of what these federal agents are going to be doing. Like you said, if they're just protecting the federal courthouse, then that's fine. Build a ring around the courthouse. If they're actively right. engaging off of that property, we have a constitutional issue, don't we?
Yeah. So there's a really interesting federalism question here, right? Police powers are largely retained by the states and local governments being creation of the states. And for much of American history, the understanding was your locality will police and protect your citizens from wrongdoing. But what we're seeing in places like Portland and Seattle with Chop Chaz and some of these other places, that there are political decisions being made by state and local elected officials to cede ground to what you have accurately described as anarchists or in some case domestic terrorists, people who have no respect for life and property. And then in those instances, what is the role of the federal government to protect the life and property within those areas that is not being protected by state and local authorities and officials, who, again, would generally be the people right. that we would expect to be protecting that?
Yeah.
And
I think go ahead. Sorry.
I really don't have a good principled answer. You know, there's all this Supreme Court jurisprudence on how you have rights as citizens of your state, but you also right. have rights as an American citizen. And so does the federal government have a duty to step in to protect your rights as an American citizen right. when your state is not protecting those? And then I think there's a very logical counter argument of a slippery slope, and to what extent
right.
we want the federal government to do that. And so to your point about lack of explanation, that's one of the things that I think is sort of missing here. If there was a clear objective, if there was a clear in cities and states that allow Antifa and some of these groups to take and hold ground as if it were an invading army, the federal government will step in and will quell those things in the event that state and local authorities either do not or cannot,
yeah.
right? Because in some of these places, it may just be a question of cannot.
But what do you do when the city is like, no, you're not welcome here, we don't want you? I mean, this is a tightrope. I mean, looking at Chop and Chaz, whatever the hell that was, in Seattle,
right.
when the mayor and the governor of Washington State decided that they would allow the police to cede the territory of the police station, the precinct, to
right.
these people, you in that moment, the state and the city egregiously violated the rights of those citizens who did not agree or want CHOP to be happening in their neighborhood. In other words,
exactly.
it was my understanding that some of the people that were in that area who weren't part of the protest had to hire private security to protect their belongings and their persons, and in order to stay safe. Those people pay
Absolutely.
Taxes that pay for that police precinct, which the governor and the mayor of the city of Seattle ceded to people who it didn't belong to. That's
exactly.
that's a very precarious place.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And so you're seeing in New York City, with some of the changes that have been put in place by Mayor de Blasio, that the New York State Police have requested to not police in New York City anymore. That,
right.
that if they have to abide by the rules that Mayor de Blasio has put out, they think that their officers will be at risk and the health and safety of their people will be at risk. Which, of course, puts the health and safety of the citizens of New York City at greater risk.
Yeah.
And so there are some very interesting legal questions here. There's some very interesting policy questions here about what you do and don't do. But I think whatever the federal government does, the way that you insulate yourself from some of those questions and the way you can build broad support around what you're doing is to fully explain what's going on, why it's happening. Why, for example, it's happening in Portland, but not in other cities that are adequately handling the violent elements of these protests. That's one of the things that really has bothered me some, is this new phrase you see in the media of mostly peaceful protests.
Mm-hmm.
It's become sort of infectious, and you'll see mostly peaceful all over local and national media. Well, of course, Jeffrey Dahmer led a mostly peaceful life. The overwhelming majority of his time was spent doing things that were largely peaceful.
Right.
Driving his car, going to work, making dinner, all those things are very peaceful.
Right.
We don't particularly care about those things. It's the not peaceful aspects of his
right.
life that are particularly problematic. And that, of course, is true with the protests.
Yeah.
I am a strong proponent of protests that are peaceful. I'm a strong proponent of protests that inconvenience people, that make people,
sure.
that force people to pay attention to them. I'm all for that. But for those individuals who would take advantage of this moment and use it to destroy and tear down and maim and cause mayhem and in some cases murder, those people belong in prison. Those are the
right.
people that we build prisons for. And so there is this delicate balance that has to be achieved, and it's only complicated when some local officials and state officials are abdicating their duty and forcing the sort of the federal government's hand to say, hey, are you going to do anything about this? And I think there's a lot of people in some of these areas that have been negatively impacted by the chop chazes and by what's going on in Portland, who look to their local officials first, nothing happens, look to their state officials first, nothing happens, and are just sort of moving their way up the tiers of federalism to try to get somebody to help them.
Well, my advice is to get out of those jurisdictions.
Right.
I posted a thing on Facebook the other day. I was like, don't go anywhere near these places. First of all, the tactics of Antifa are brilliant and they're brutal. And the way that they attack you is that they surround you and someone will begin to distract you by getting in your face but not touching you. And then someone behind you will hit you over the head with a 2x4. And then when they're called before the judge, it was you that attacked them. And unfortunately, all the witnesses are also conveniently participants. And then what you have is you have these people that are being allowed to operate by politicians in these jurisdictions. These politicians, a lot of times DAs or prosecutors are elected officials that are elected in those districts. You're going to deal with a jury from that district. And, you know, somebody who tries to defend themselves using some sort of force finds themselves in a very precarious situation. This St. Louis couple is a perfect example of this. They did a lot of things wrong in the way that they defended their home, a lot. They need serious firearms training, no question.
Right.
And there's no question they probably had a couple of infractions. But how ironic is it that these people are being charged with a felony who never fired a shot, never even really did anything. Well, the lady was pointing a gun, but they were allegedly threatened that their house was going to be burned down and they were going to be killed. So they came out on their lawn to establish a sense of force that they were going to defend themselves. They're being charged with a felony, and I don't know of anyone from that mob that broke into their neighborhood that's being put on trial.
Right.
So, I mean, my point is, my advice is leave those jurisdictions. Don't let your tax dollars be used against you. And in a little bit, people will start to realize just how bad this is. I mean, maybe that's not the right direction to go, but there's no winning with these people. When you have U.S. Congresswomen, who I just retweeted this morning, I can't remember her name. She posted a thing. She was like, cancel rent, cancel mortgage, cancel college debt. And I'm like, you have members of Congress who are never going to be affected by their policies.
Right.
But they're advocating things that destroy everyone else's lives.
Right. Yeah, that was Ayanna Pressley, who's a congresswoman from Massachusetts, member of the squad. So I think there's some.
I gave you a lot to unpack there, so.
Yeah. No, I think there's some efficacy in that, right? Saying, like, okay, it's time to step aside from the radicalism, right? And there's a part of me who says, like, this is liberal crap to figure out, right?
Right.
This is something that the sane liberals, who I disagree with on many policy areas, but ultimately agree with on sort of the rules by which we are going to play the game. It's a battle between them and their radical fringe, and it's for you all to figure out. It's the same thing that folks have said about Confederate monuments. Those are statues to Democrat officials and Democrat politicians that Democrats now want to take down. That's your problem, not mine. That's the Democrats' problem.
Right.
And so I'm sympathetic to the, like, let the left figure their crap out, and then we'll come back to the table. But the thing that I am keenly aware of is there's a possibility that the radicals win.
Yeah.
And
if
that's the case, then it does become my problem, because they become my primary ideological opponent. And they haven't agreed to the rules that the rest of us have agreed to. They don't believe in the institutions and the foundations that we had previously agreed to. And so it is important to, I think, be ready to combat these ideas regardless of where somebody is, right? Because maybe you do move out of Portland, maybe you do move out of St. Louis, maybe you do move out of one of these places, and so your mayor's not this way anymore. But if this becomes the prevailing philosophy of one of the two major parties, and your governor ends up this way? Are you going to move out of state?
Right.
That becomes much more difficult for people. And, you know, Bernie Sanders, despite, you know, being well past the age of Social Security eligibility, has amassed a major following in two presidential runs. What happens when the young, charismatic Bernie Sanders comes along?
Right.
And now you're in a country where the chief executive, that's the prevailing opinion and position of. And so I do think there's a responsibility for those of us who self-identify as conservative or libertarian or free market or traditionalist, these kinds of things, to be ready to fight this at an ideological level and speak to people and say, no, this is why this is not better for you. Mm-hmm. This is why this is not good for this country. And here's why what we believe is good for you and is good for this country.
Yeah. I agree with that. I want to go back to the federal police thing, and then I want to talk about defunding police. But the one thing I do want to say is I think every American should be watchful of this situation, even if you agree that the protesters in Portland have been violent and deserve to pay the consequences. We don't want it, and I'm always disturbed at the number of so-called conservatives who throw in with government abuse when it's done by the right, and then they suddenly become these defiant patriots when it's done by the left. Many of the people that I stood side by side with during the Tea Party movement when President Obama was weaponizing the IRS against conservatives and conservative groups in order to quell the Tea Party, you know, those same people are now in favor of big government type moves, authoritarian type moves that Trump may be engaging in. Again, there may be, and I agree with you, there's absolute right of the feds to come in and protect that courthouse building. And they're going to have to engage if they get engaged. And I totally get that as well. But at the same time, I think we should keep an eye on this, because I don't think it's right for us to send the feds into every one of these cities that are having problems. There's still an element of local responsibility that needs to take care of it. And I also think it's a violation of the Constitution if they are doing anything beyond protecting federal property.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a tale as old as time in some regard, right? Senator Paul here in Kentucky talks about this all the time with regards to deficit spending. Whenever we are in the minority, my goodness, we care about deficits, and yeah, deficits are going to, yeah, wreck this country. And as soon as it's our money that we get to spend, it ain't no thing. And that's been one of my frustrations with elected politics, basically since the Tea Party movement, that because when we're in the minority and we're talking about that, the deficits and national debt, we're right. And we should continue to be right whenever we control things. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's not the case. And I think the same is true here, right? And the use of the federal government to enforce what we think are our values. I do think that there's a limiting principle here that is possible if that limiting principle is literal violence, right? If we want to use that as a limiting principle and say it's acceptable for federal law enforcement to protect human life because that's enshrined in the Declaration of, right, Independence and the Constitution. And so perhaps there's a legitimate limiting principle there, but it is, again, one of these things that is a very slippery slope.
We have two big problems with being able to see through the smoke. One, the smoke generated by the Trump administration, and two, the smoke generated by the media. You know, again, right, I go back to the Washington Post article I read this morning, and it was clearly praising the protesters. And I'm like, do you see what they have done to the city of Portland? They've destroyed it.
Mm-hmm.
They've destroyed, right, the inner core of that city. And I'm like, there's no defending them, but there does have to be an understanding of what the constitutional line is. So on the one side, we have the media that is telling us, oh, they're kidnapping them in vans. I don't know if that's true. If that's true, I'm very disturbed by that. If the feds are plucking, right, protesters off the street in unmarked vans and taking them to some black site somewhere, that's scary as hell, and we all need to stand up against that. But I don't know if that's true. I just know the Washington Post reports this and that and this other thing, and then the Trump administration gives a smoke in the other direction, and I'm like, well, it's hard for the American people to figure out exactly what they should think about this situation.
Right, Absolutely. And that's our problem with everything right now, right? Is the administration gives one perspective, the media almost reflexively gives the other perspective, and all of it is amplified on social media.
Right.
We live in the age of partial clips, right?
Yeah.
And you get to see a 30 second snippet of what was a 6 minute interaction.
Right.
And that 30 second snippet looks really bad for one side or the other. But if you watch all 6 minutes, all of a sudden things start to make a lot more sense.
Yeah, 100%. So let's talk defunding the police. You guys have done an enormous amount of work at the Pegasus Institute about why this is a bad idea, why it would fail, and why it would end up harming the people that it's intended to protect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there have been bad policy ideas since people started thinking about public policy. But you would be hard-pressed to find in sort of modern American life a policy idea this bad that has gotten this much attention, right? Now, the American people and the public reject it outright, and they're right to do so, but defund the police has become the rallying cry of a lot of these protesters and groups. It's gotten favorable treatment in certain media entities, but it, as a matter of policy, would be the exact opposite of what we need for a lot of these localities. That's not to say that there aren't things that can be done to reform the way that we police, that improve community police relations, reduce negative interactions between law enforcement and the community, reduce deadly interactions between law enforcement and the community. But it is to say that almost all of those things will require more money, not less. And so all you're going to do by defunding the police is put less qualified officers on the street and abandon the neighborhoods that are most in need of good law enforcement.
I think you're going to end up putting more authoritarian type police on the street, because I think what's going to happen is it's going to be a matter of risk mitigation, right? Like, so you have what we call sheepdogs, the people in our society who are sort of born to protect, if you will. And those guys get up every morning and all they want to do is protect their community and their family and then go home safe. That they live to protect people. They're not in the business of law enforcement because they want the power and they want this or that. So they're not interested in risking their own family's livelihood because they might get falsely accused of something. They're going to be out. What you're going to be left with is the percentage of people among the population who like authority, get off on authority, and don't care about the risks. So you're going to end up with people who are going to be more letter of the law, less congenial, less interactive. They're not going to care about interacting with citizens because it's not going to do them any good. And you're going to have this very cold, very by the book, very authoritarian policing that's going to come out of this, because that's going to be the only people that are going to be interested in taking the job.
Yeah, I think that's certainly possible. And you're just going to have less, period. I mean, you and I have talked about something like this before, but one of the statistics that we care deeply about here at Pegasus is self-initiated policing numbers and
right.
The relationship that self-initiated policing has with reductions in crime, in particular violent crime, homicides and murders. And so if you have 100 officers doing 100 instances of self-initiated policing a year, just to make the math easy, and you defund the police so that now you only have 90 officers, if those 90 officers are doing the exact same work, the exact same good work that they were doing before, you've still lost 10% of
right.
your self-initiated police activity
right.
because you've cut your force by 10%.
Right.
And so you're seeing some of this play out in New York City right now. They have made the decision to cut the NYPD budget by $1 billion. To eliminate plainclothes officer units and things like that. And people don't feel as safe. Communities are, in fact, not as safe. And all over the country right now, and especially here in Louisville, you are seeing shooting and homicide numbers go up. Here in Louisville, where we were in a pretty bad place to start with, we've just seen those exacerbated. But in places like New York City and Los Angeles that have been on a decades-long crime decline and have really done really good work in those cities, you're starting to see numbers rebound in the wrong direction.
Right. self-initiated policing, I know we've talked about it before. For those that might not understand what you're talking about, kind of explain that process. It's really a vital part of policing. It's an interactive type of policing. It's not getting all up in people's business, as it's been accused of, but it's policemen paying attention to their surroundings, understanding the community that they're working in, noticing when something is out of place.
Absolutely. So self-initiated policing, broadly speaking, is basically everything an officer does that is not a direct call for service. And so it can be making a motor vehicle stop or stopping somebody on the street, but it also includes things like checking on abandoned cars, checking on abandoned buildings, checking in with businesses, checking in with community members. And so it not only can build some of that trust up, but that active presence in neighborhoods disincentivizes criminal behavior. If you are more likely to have an active cop on your one block street segment, you're less likely to commit crime on that one block street segment. And so this is the sort of age old getting officers out of their motor out of their vehicles, interacting with the public, interacting with businesses, interacting with the community. And some of that is directly enforcement related in terms of stops and things like that. But some of it is just what people think of as community policing and interacting and getting to know people and getting to know what the problems are there. And so it is a vital, vital part of policing. Arguably much more vital than direct responses to calls for service, because in a lot of instances, by the time an officer shows up on a direct call for service, what they're doing is taking a report and beginning an investigation rather than directly deterring or intervening with something.
Right, right. By the way, just a quick update on the thing we started off the conversation on. Apparently, the president has called the mayor of Chicago to coordinate agreement on federal deployment there. So that is the way it should be done. If there are federal properties in the city of Chicago that need to be protected, then the president and the president feels like that needs to happen, then he needs to be coordinating locally. I've always felt from the beginning of the George Floyd case that President Trump should have put boots on the ground, not other boots. He should have been on the ground in Minneapolis within a few days of that situation breaking and going there and talking to those people and saying, what can we do to make this situation better? He failed to lead in that moment. And I think he turned towards this sort of typical right versus left, my side versus your side way of dealing with this issue. And I think there was a huge opportunity to probably avoid most of what we've seen over the last month or so had he gone there and said, let's have a summit. You know, everybody laughed at President Obama when he had the beer summit, and I think rightfully so, because that was a contrived situation that really was unfair to the police. But the president at that time was forced to have something that sort of saved everybody's face, right? In this case, the president should have had some sort of summit in Minneapolis to say, all right, we hear you. This is a problem. We haven't paid enough attention to it. We need reform. Tell us what you need, and let's find a way to work together. Had he done that, I think we would have avoided a lot of the trouble we've had in the last 60, 70 days.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing about the longer that these kinds of events go on, is your more moderate voices tend to go back to work, go back to raising a family, and what you're left with is your most radicalized voices. And so it becomes all the more difficult to have those kinds of moments, because a lot of the folks that are left, that are out on the street, are not the good faith actors that were out there the first week,
right,
who want to see more racial justice in the country, who want to see people who do truly bad things held accountable. But what you're left with is the defund the police crowd and the burn it down crowd and the this is ours now crowd and Naked Athena.
Yeah.
So that's what you're left with.
Yeah. By the way, to your point, Maryland County Police Chief, one of the counties in Maryland, Anne Arundel County, which is a very large one, it borders Baltimore, that police chief has resigned. And because of reforms that he says will make cops and residents unsafe. So that's what you were pointing to. There's going to be a lot more. Yeah. The good cops are all going to leave. That terrifies me, and it should terrify every American. Another thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap up today is the governor's ridiculous comments about unemployment. Bluegrass Politics posted on Twitter yesterday, and then I retweeted it. The governor basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have the tweet right in front of me, but he essentially said, hey, if you think somebody making $600 unemployment benefits is not going to look for work because of that $600, then maybe these people are not paying their people enough to begin with. And I'm like, I posted, this showed a very huge lack of understanding how the economy works. This is a $600 weekly federal benefit that's piled on top of the state benefit. My understanding is that Kentucky's unemployment benefit max is about $500. Is that right?
Yep.
That's $1,100 to $1,200 per week. That's almost $60,000 a year that you can get by staying home. Not only is that above the poverty level, that is good money. And for him to say that somehow or another the federal benefit is not a disincentive to work, and that's essentially the point he was making. He was saying, this isn't a disincentive to work. Oh, hell yeah, it is. And I've heard from so many business owners, small business owners, that are like, I can't get my staff to come back to work because they're sitting at home making $600 a week, which is more than that they were making when they were working for me. And for the right. governor to sit there and say, well, that means they're not paying them enough, go talk to that small business about the cost of staffing and the cost of running business and seeing what their profit margin is and tell them that you think that they can pay them $60,000 a year to do fast food service. Come on, man. I mean, this was the most ridiculous thing I think he's said since he's been in office, besides when he sicked the state police on churchgoers during the COVID.
Right. So part of it is when you're looking at especially part-time food service workers, people who are waiting tables, but working at coffee shops, that kind of stuff. For those folks, it's a benefit above and beyond what they would normally make.
Right.
But I think the bigger thing is something that Councilman Anthony Piacentini, who is a regular guest of yours, commented on Facebook on this, is that the calculation is not about how much this benefit is versus how much people get paid. The calculation is I'm getting this money right now and not having to do anything.
Right.
If I can go out and get a job that pays me $1,000 more a month, but I now have to work 40 hours a week, am I going to ride out this benefit till it's over?
Right.
Or am I going to go work 40 hours a week and make only $1,000 more a month?
Right. You're not taking into account important factors like I don't have to sit in traffic for an hour each way and deal with that frustration. I don't have to get up an hour early. And if you're a female, a lot of times, you know, like my wife, she gets up like 45 minutes before she even leaves the house just to put her makeup on or whatever. Got to take a shower. You got to do all this stuff. You don't have to do any of that stuff. There's hours of your time that go into work that aren't at work. You don't calculate that. And people sit back and go, I don't have to do anything but watch Netflix. And maybe I got a little less money in my pocket, I guess, for expenditures. But then I'm not spending anything because I'm just sitting at home. Yeah, I saw that post by Piacentini, and he was dead on. It's like he's not, but that again just underscores how out of touch this governor is with the average person.
And the other thing that complicates all of this, right? And we're in the summertime right now, so it's not quite as relevant. But if schools are not going to be open,
right.
If daycares are not open, and what is relevant for the summer is if summer camps aren't open, then you have to figure out the childcare question in an environment where it's much, much more difficult.
Right.
And so not only is that an additional financial expense, and probably more so than it normally would be because a lot of the traditional avenues for childcare aren't open, but you have to then make the decision of, okay, I'm going to send my child to this environment that they may end up contracting coronavirus in, and even though it will not negatively impact them. In all likelihood, statistically, my mom and dad live with us and they're 60 plus. And there's just all these questions and factors, some of which have nothing to do with sort of the leeching off the government question, but in this coronavirus environment are just additional concerns that people have that go into those questions. But as policymakers, you have to say, okay, the country has to get back to work. We need people back in work. We need people producing. And so we have to take those things into effect. And so to dismiss that $600 a week federal benefit as not relevant to whether people are working or not working is not factually accurate and really is not good good policy.
Well, there's another aspect to this too, and that is that in order to get that benefit, you actually have to actually get it. And so the governor's dealing with two problems here: one being completely out of touch with the amount that the benefits are actually a disincentive to work, and the fact that there's a lot of Kentuckians who didn't even get that, and are still sitting at home waiting for it because of the way our unemployment system was actually handled in the first place. So it's absolutely ridiculous. All right, one other quick thing. I came across this. Have you guys at the Pegasus Institute done anything on the science behind masks, or are you planning on, or is that just more of a non-policy thing that you don't want to deal with, or what?
Yeah, so we haven't done independent work on masks. I sort of, as an interested, concerned citizen, end up reading a ton about the masks. But we haven't done any specific work on it.
Okay, well, then stepping apart from the Pegasus, let's talk about this for a second, because I came across this poll. Mediaite had it, and it was stunning. 72% of Americans, including most Republicans, support jailing or fining people who don't wear masks. And then they broke those numbers down. It was like 86% of Democrats are like, yeah, throw them in jail. 72% of Americans in total, and 68% of independents, and 59% of Trump voters. Here's the thing, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this too. I was trail running this morning, and there was a lady coming up the other direction, and I always get a kind of a kick out of people that you can tell live in fear. And I'm not wearing a mask when I'm trail running, trust me. And she's coming up, and she's got her little walking sticks, and she sees me coming down the hill, and she's literally, I can see it. I was like, I'm not slowing down. I'm going to keep running. I tried to go as far around her as I could, but she's panicking. I can see her hands. She's shaking her hands. She's trying to get to her mask. Trying to get it on faster before I get there. She just gets it over her nose as I run past her. And I'm just like, really? One thing is that from what I've read, and you tell me since you've looked into it, maybe I'm wrong, or if you've seen other information, we should absolutely wear masks in tight quarters. If you have to go into a grocery store, if you have to go in a place where you're going to be in contact with people, you should absolutely wear a mask, although you should change it often. Because Congressman Massey had a great point on here. He said, what is the best way to create an aerosol if you don't have one? It's to soak a piece of cloth and then blow air through it, which is essentially, if you spend 5 hours in the same mask and you've got stuff you want to spread, you're blowing it onto the fabric, soaking it with your spittle, and then you're blowing air through it, which basically amplifies the effect of your spreading the disease. So there's no discussion about that aspect of it. But then when we're outside, my understanding is there's heavy research that shows that the UV light basically kills the thing. As far as I know, there's only one case in the world recorded of a transmission of the coronavirus in outdoor setting. And it was a situation where the people were talking for like 2 or 3 hours. So I think people should wear them in tight quarters in quick in and outs. Other than that, I think we should live our lives. What do you think?
Yeah, so my fundamental principle on this is I'm for anything that keeps us from locking down again. So if that
totally
means,
agree with that.
So if that means everybody wears a mask and it's largely a placebo effect to make us feel better and we're wearing masks all day, every day, if it means we don't lock down again, I'm for it.
Right.
If you're supposed to wear a mask to bed and it means we don't lock down again, I'm for it.
Right.
I do think that the American people have largely done the mask thing right in the absence of government action. So polling suggests that more than 60% of respondents say that they put a mask on every time they leave the house.
Right.
There's also a large swath that says that they mostly do or usually do things like that. And so people are risk averse as a general principle. And if they believe that the mask will help, they'll put on the mask and they'll do what they're told. And in the context of close quarters, especially indoors, especially for prolonged periods of time, it makes a lot of sense. And so there's a legitimate case to be made for wearing masks in environments like that. Although some of our most populous environments like that, it's entirely impractical to wear a mask.
Right.
Restaurants are an example of this. You can't really wear a mask and eat at a restaurant, but a restaurant is indoors with an air conditioning unit, and you're in there for more than an hour. So there's things that limit all that. But it is one of those things where I am not surprised anymore when I read something that the American people are willing to give up some level of liberty to to try to mitigate this virus. I was early on in all this, but none of it surprises me anymore.
Yeah,
because I was shocked then by the way folks acquiesced to some of the government crackdowns. But
yeah.
My bigger thing is anything that keeps us from shutting down again. If wearing shoes on our hands is going to help us from shutting down again, I'm team shoe hands.
Team shoe hands. Isn't that like the chainsaw hand bears that are supposed to be next after the murder hornets and the COVID?
It's something like that, yeah.
I always want to know. I want to notate, though, I was in the gym the other day, and a little girl comes over, and she works at the gym, and she's like, "Excuse me, sir, do you have a mask?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I got it right here." And I was in a section of the gym. It was like a CrossFit section. There was literally nobody there. It was early in the morning. There was literally nobody there. No one. Mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, it's right here, but there's nobody over here." And she goes, "Yeah, but you need to put it on." And I was like, "I cannot breathe while I'm doing my exercises with this thing on. I don't make the rules." I'm like, "All right, whatever." So 2 days later, I get an email from the gym, and the gym is like, "You no longer have to wear your mask while you're doing your exercises." Because I actually went over and explained to them. I was like, "Look, you know, here's the thing. When you're wearing the mask, if you're exerting yourself, ironically, you're actually doing the same thing to your body that COVID does. You're lowering the amount of oxygen in your blood. It's like training at high right. altitude, which if you want to climb a 14er, great, put a mask on. But if you don't... You know, right. if you don't want to do that, then you probably are going to create lower oxygen in your blood, which is probably going to be a bad thing. So, again, I'm with you. I wear my mask when I go into a store or something like that because for the same reason I carry my firearm concealed. I don't want to freak people out. And it's right. if it makes everybody feel better and helps us all get along, I'm cool with it. And I also see – I mean, I use the analogy, if you put me in a, you know, 15 by – a 10 by 15 room, and right in the middle of that room, you cross it with jail bars that are just wide enough for me to slip through. And then you tell me to run from one side of the room to the other, and then you blindfold me. What are the chances I run into one of the bars, right?
Right.
That logic is why I think a mask has some mitigating effect, right? What are the chances it catches on the cloth instead of going out into the open air? Probably pretty right. good that at least a portion of it, you know, it's not as effective, but it's the same concept as a contraceptive in a way, right? Like if you can keep
right.
things all into one area, maybe something doesn't happen. So I totally agree with you. I don't agree with mandates because I just don't like the government telling. I don't agree with putting ankle bracelets right. on people like that Kentucky couple that's dealing with that. But I do right. I do agree that the masks have some mitigating effect. We should wear them. It's just interesting that, once again, we don't have anybody in the public square that's out there explaining the science behind it, because the government started off by telling us we didn't need to wear them, they weren't effective, which didn't make any sense to me, because I was like, well, then why do hospital workers need them if it's not effective for the general public, right? And right. then they flip, but there's no intervening information scientifically about why they do or don't work.
Right.
Well, that was a lot of stuff. All right. Josh, it's always good to have you on. Thank you so much for your time today. I know you're busy. I got to let you go, but it's always good talking to you. And thanks for what you do at the Pegasus Institute. People can get a hold of you at PegasusKentucky.org. Is there a project you're getting ready to release that you want people to be watching your website for?
So we've put out some stuff recently, a lot of the stuff on the Defund the Police, but also some stuff on Kentucky's emergency declaration of emergency statutes. We've done a 50-state cross-examination of how different states do declarations of emergency, and we've basically put together what we think the model for that should be that
yeah.
Balances powers appropriately, involves legislators as well as the governor's office, but also allows governors the flexibility to act quickly for short periods of time when they need to. So folks may be interested in that.
Okay, awesome. Good stuff. And you guys have a podcast too. How can people get a hold of that?
So that's the Pegasus Podcast. You can find it sort of wherever you you listen to your podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. I think we're on SoundCloud as well, some of these other places.
Good. Awesome. We always set a goal of 30 minutes and then we go way over.
Absolutely.
All right. Good to talk to you. Have a great day, buddy. Stay safe.
You too, Leland. Thanks.
All right. Josh Crawford, Pegasus Institute. I love those guys. They do a lot of good work. So here's what I would do, because, you know, the media is untrustworthy at this point, completely untrustworthy. Right or left, man. It's like everything is shaded. If you want the facts, people ask me all the time. They're like, what show prep do you use? What websites do you go to get your information? This is one of them. PegasusKentucky.org. I want you to put that on your favorites bar. on your browser so that you can go to it, because they have a ton of information and they've got data to back it up. You just go to their website right now. They've got white papers up there, policy briefs, economics and school choice in Kentucky, competition and certificate of need laws, benefits of work, case for cops 3.0. That's just four of the top things that they have on their website, but there's tons more. There's a lot of information. So if you're wanting to explain to people why the defunding cops is a bad idea and you want the actual data to back it up, go here to the Pegasus website. It's PegasusKentucky.org. Hey, thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills. Thank you to JP Web Design for their help with the show. And also thanks to Dynamics Audio Productions in Lexington, Kentucky, the horse capital of the world, for their help with our production of this program. Thank you to you. Literally still getting thousands of downloads a week, and we love that. We're growing every week, and thank you so much. There's much more to come. I have some big announcements soon. They're exciting. I think you're going to love this, so stay tuned. Catch us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or iHeartRadio's app. Go to iHeartRadio's app and search in the search bar for The Disruption Zone. They will deliver fresh episodes directly to your pocket. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.